Hello, this is Craig Francis, and this is number 0496 of The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder, and it's coming to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0496. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Ivan Obolensky, author of Eye of the Moon. He talks about his gothic mystery and also about the 1% of which he was privileged to grow up as.
One of the really interesting things, and a really positive element of it, was you really learned manners. That is to say, I mean, you were really inculcated in, you know, which fork, you know, how do you talk to people? I mean, I remember talking to the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, you know, when I was like 6 and 7. I mean, it was one of those, you know, you were paraded out, you know, when you were a kid to say goodnight, and there you are in your bathrobe talking to all these people, and you go, whoa, you know, it was an incredible thing, so you're not necessarily intimidated by people.
Actress Gillian Clare, who produced and stars in the indie flick Pretty Broken, what led to her making this picture?
I got the script for Pretty Broken, which at the time was called Free for All, in about 2013, I believe it was. And when I got the script, I immediately fell in love with the character, and I thought that it was interesting to show a young woman who's not in college and isn't, you know, addicted to drugs or having these awful things happen to her. It's just a real slice of life. And I think it's very hard to come by in my generation to find films that really just touch on super truthful moments in a character's life. And that's why I fell in love with it.
Ernie Smith from Tedium, the dull side of the internet, is back. He shares the history of the suggestion box.
It really kind of came into its own in the days of the Industrial Revolution, especially as it kind of sped up during the wartime years during World War II. And basically, the idea was to offer sort of a line of communication between leadership and the employees, to basically have a place to allow ideas not to kind of die in the vine, but, you know, to actually reach somebody of note.
And there's lots and lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0496, was Craig Francis, who is co-author and co-creator of several shows at Kidoons, including 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and The Jungle Book. He's also working as a producer and stage manager on Boom X. That's Rick Miller's Gen X hit as it tours Canada. And for more information, you can visit their website at kidoons.com. That's K-I-D-O-O-N-S, kidoons.com. And Craig, in addition to all that he does, is also an extremely fine human being. Just got to put that out there. Thank you very much, Craig, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, I want to start off by saying that through the years, I have usually avoided stories like this first one that deals with someone trying to draw in the attention of a minor because, frankly, those stories are disgusting. But I have to share this moron's tale of woe. 28-year-old Joshua Lewis Hilliard was arrested in Cottonwood, Arizona, charged with felony furnishing harmful materials to a minor after a 16-year-old girl went to the police officer at her school to say that she had received unsolicited, inappropriate pictures and messages from him. Now, the pictures included one of his genitals, and it's easy to prove it's a photo of him because of his distinctive tattoo visible in the photo. It reads, "Fun size." Okay, here's why I'm sharing this story. It's the lack of logic on the part of several people. First of all, there is a tattoo artist out there who is willing to tattoo someone's junk. Now, getting a tattoo takes more than a minute or two. What kind of small talk goes on while you're busy etching phrases on a phallus? Do you talk about the weather, the latest sports news, politics? And secondly, if you know the history of the term fun size, then I think that tattoo would be kind of embarrassing. For those of you who don't know that term, Mars Incorporated went to court in the 1970s because they coined the term, and when other companies also started using the phrase, Mars tried to sue, and they lost. The term was coined to apply to candy bars that are less than 2 inches in length. Now, given the history, is that something you really want etched in down there? Really? Adrian Murray was walking his dog in Palm Bay, Florida. The occupants of one house came out, confronted Murray about the flashlight he carried, which they said woke them up every morning. According to police, Tabitha Del Villar started screaming profanities at Murray. When she got in his face, he pushed her back, and a fight ensued. Tabitha allegedly took Murray's flashlight and used it to hit him in the face. Murray called the police, who tried talking with Tabitha in the house, but she ran out to her backyard and hid in a cat cage. Officers discovered she had an outstanding warrant for a probation violation and arrested her and added charges of aggravated battery and theft. Well, at least she's now going to have a bigger cage. When firefighters responded to a house fire on February 5th in Altoona, Pennsylvania, 37-year-old resident Holly Williams was happy to tell them how it started. She and 38-year-old Michael Miller kept their car fuel in a container in the house, and they were arguing about his drinking, and he was trying to take their car, so she flushed the gasoline down the toilet. Miller threw a lit cigarette in the toilet, and as flames spread, Williams ran out of the house and called 911. Miller was arrested for arson, risking catastrophe, and recklessly endangering another person. Later, Williams was charged as well. Now, there's a loving couple, huh? I wonder if they got out of jail early enough to celebrate Valentine's Day. And by the way, anyone curious about why they kept gasoline in the house? Do they live in such a high-crime area that people are siphoning out gasoline at night? Wouldn't a locking gas cap solve that problem? These are questions that I want to know, but I'm not going to lose sleep over it. Anyway, let's get to our last story in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our first guest here on the program, shall we? And speaking of toilets, like that last story, city crews in Albany, New York, investigating the source of raw sewage being dumped into the Hudson River, found it. A 5-story building had never been hooked up to the city's sewer system. Its sewage, about 5 gallons a minute, were flowing into a storm drain which led to the river. The sewer pipes in the area were installed in 1913, so the problem had been going on for more than a century. Someone back in 1913 was not doing their job, offered Albany Water Commissioner Joe Coffey, who says the city will pay for the work to hook up the building. When we find issues like this, we fix them. Oh, there's a fine quote. Yeah, you find issues and fix them. The question that worries citizens is, when? You have to agree that a century is a long time to wait. Also, this is a slightly new situation for me. When I normally talk about things floating in the Hudson, I'm usually talking about around New York City, not upstream in Albany. Everybody knows that should you happen to fall into the Hudson River, the first thing you need is to be rescued, and the second thing you need is a tetanus shot. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? We often hear about the wealthy of this world as the 1%, and when that's discussed, it's often in a negative connotation. So, what are some of the myths and misconceptions about the 1%? Well, to get the answer to that question, we talked to a member of their group. Ivan Obolensky is the grandson of Serge Obolensky, a.k.a. the Prince of New York, who married Alice Astor, daughter of John Jacob Astor, who famously died on the Titanic. He's also the author of the gothic mystery Eye of the Moon. Ivan joins us via Skype from Uruguay. Hi, Ivan.
Hey there, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for taking the time to chat with us. The 1%, people often talk negatively, as I said in the intro, about the 1%. But what I think they're really talking about is the 1% that may have inherited a lot of wealth as opposed to earned a lot of wealth. Would you agree with that assessment?
I think that's true. But I think there's also... there's a difference between, say, a 1%er, because it's confusing, because there's people who have a tremendous amount of assets. And having assets is not necessarily the same thing as having gigantic incomes. And you have the 1%, which is considered anybody who's making, say, over $1 million a year. Okay, that's one type of 1%. The other type of 1% is the people who... you know, through family and, you know, and inheritances and passing on, you know, generation unto the generation. The Rockefellers would be an example of that, for instance, where it's just they just keep on going. And so that's sort of what I think of the 1%. I usually look at the asset element of it as opposed to the income element of it.
So where do you put yourself in that category?
I don't put myself in that either of those categories particularly. I'm not necessarily, my family is very, very wealthy. I'm an author, so I'm not necessarily, rolling in the dough. But, you know, that doesn't mean that I wasn't brought up, in a lifestyle which was different from most everybody. I mean, I was chauffeured to school, and that had, good news and bad news. The good news was that I got chauffeured to school. The bad news is people didn't necessarily like that. And, I had to, every now and again, I had one person absolutely go ballistic over that. And, there were, a bunch of fist fights and stuff like that. And, but that was, I guess, part of the game. And that sort of changed a lot of how I viewed things. And, one of the things I noted for myself was, I wasn't necessarily the most ostentatious person that ever lived.
Okay, so what are some of the myths, as I mentioned, myths and misconceptions, as I mentioned in the introduction when I spoke to you earlier?
Well, I think some of the myths are that, they're basically ethically challenged, morally deficient, and just generally underhanded. And I think that's a very wrong misconception. One of the interesting things about the 1% is that they want to make a mark on the world and leave a legacy. And what that legacy is to be determined. But in the past, you have tremendous numbers of foundations, museums, theater, ballet, orchestras, which have been, I guess, underwritten by a great number of the 1%. And, from the Metropolitan Museum of Art to the New York Public Library to, the foundations that these people have put there have helped thousands and thousands of people. And, and they make they look at culture as being something that can be carried on. And I think that's the legacy element is, I think, a really key element that really determines if a person is really part of the 1%.
So as you mentioned, you're an author, and we'll get to your book, Eye of the Moon, in a moment. But let me ask you this question, going back to your youth. Was there any pressure on you growing up as to what you were going to do and what you were going to be because of the legacy of your family's history?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was a burden that was that was put on you at an early age. I mean, first of all, one of the really interesting things was, and a really positive element of it was, you really learned manners. That is to say, you were really inculcated in, which fork, how do you talk to people? I remember talking to, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, when I was like 6 and 7. It was one of those, you were paraded out, when you were a kid, to say goodnight. And there you are in your bathrobe, talking to all these people. And you go, whoa, it was an incredible thing. So you're not necessarily intimidated by people. I did do a couple of things which were really sort of amusing, I suppose. I did manage to pee on JFK, which was, you know, not the best thing to do. I was 2 years old. Then I met him at the White House, and I remember going, oh, my gosh, does he remember that? And luckily, you know, he was very grand, and you know, he didn't mention it at all. I was mortified because he said, oh, this is the president. I go, oh, my gosh. You know, it's one of those. But yeah, the thing is, I think that's really an important attribute. If I were to say if I got anything from my upbringing was, you know, to not necessarily be intimidated by status. And, you know, to really look at the person. And, you know, a lot of the people that I met were real people that actually cared about what was going on and what was happening around them.
Well, you mentioned earlier that the 1% like to leave a legacy of culture, such as composers and the like. Would authors fit under that category? And was your family okay with the idea of you being a writer?
Not particularly. I was always, you know, marching to a different drum and a different rhythm than everybody else. And, you know, so I was always on the outside. I mean, particularly because, you know, just the way I did things. And I did not necessarily toe the line. And there was a lot of line towing that you had to do. I mean, well, that was one of the things that, you know, that was pretty clear even at the outset. Toe the line and, you know, you could be part of that, you know, legacy, so to speak, failed to toe the line, and you would be, you know, ostracized to a degree. And, you know, it was interesting. I mean, I remember making that choice at a fairly early age. That's not to say that I don't have a lot of friends that are really part of that 1%. And, you know, I really appreciate, but I have been always on the outside, which also it was great for being an author because, you know, as a writer, you can take a view outside it as opposed to being in it and not seeing what's going on.
Well, tell me about your book, Eye of the Moon.
Well, Eye of the Moon, it took place. My father had a large house in Rhinebeck, which was originally Alice Astor's, that Vincent Astor gave to Alice and my grandfather. And I grew up there, go there on vacations. My parents got divorced, so we went there. And Alice was very much into Egyptology. She died reading the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which was interesting. I remember my father, you know, talking to me about this and telling me this story over lunch at the St. Regis. We would always end up having lunches at the St. Regis, and that was really cool. But then I saw in W magazine that there was a rumor that she might have been murdered, and I went, "Whoa, that's news to me." And but I looked at that and I said, "Well, what led to all of this?" And so I came up with a story, and in some ways it talks about, you know, how I grew up. It's about two young men who spend a weekend at that particular house and the many machinations and secrets which are slowly revealed, because then nothing is what it seems. And in some ways, that's also very, very true of, you know, the 1%. You may find that, you know, you expect something and you see something totally different. And I think that would also be sort of an idea that's, you know, has relevance.
So since you've kind of blazed your own trail and broken away from what the family core may have wanted you to do, now that you've written this book, and it does, in a way, deal a little bit with your own family, has your family come around to the idea that, yes, Ivan's a writer?
I think they have. I mean, some of them have written, I've read it, and I've actually really enjoyed it. Others have refused to read it. Not, you know, and probably, you know, if you put a gun to their head, they're not going to read it. So it's one of those. But, you know, I've read some friends of mine who were also definitely part of the 1% have read it, and they just loved it. It's got enough, you know, family dynamics, and, you know, there's finance and all sorts of stuff. I mean, that's also one of the things that I think is really important or to know about the 1% is they have usually field a whole team of people. I mean, there's not just one little guy. I mean, it's like accountants, it's lawyers, it's trusts, it's people really, you know, who have really sort of worked out how it is that wealth can be transferred to the next generation.
Is there, especially with your book out now, is your family's guard up? And the reason why I say that is the 1%, and I'm not making any apologies for them, but the 1% really is getting trashed in the media a lot these days. Basically because, let's be honest, you currently have a president in the United States who was part of the 1% who seems to be catering to them.
Yes, I know what you're saying. Yeah, that's the other element that, you know, the 1% has. And that is everybody knows everybody. And if you know everybody, you also know the people that don't know everybody. And that you have, it gets cliquey. And you're right. And that's that can be a problem. Again, that is not my world particularly, nor do I necessarily want to be part of that world. That was a choice. I mean, I live in Uruguay, for gosh sakes, you know. It's like, I'm nowhere near this. And I must admit, it is very, you know, interesting being all the way down here. And you can just feel the fur flying, you know, up north. The country is very polarized. And I find that very unfortunate, although not exactly unanticipated. I mean, usually the U.S. goes through an 80-year cycle anyway. I mean, if you start rocking it back 80 years, you know, you end up with World War II, 80 years back, it's the Civil War, 80 years back, and you're into the revolution. The U.S. does this. And it's an interesting phenomenon. The really great thing that happens is that the U.S., when it does get as polarized as it is right now, eventually a whole new concept comes out, and you know, the whole country shifts its thinking. And I don't know what's going to precipitate that and what that thinking is. I don't think Lincoln really knew. I mean, Lincoln sort of gave a bit of a foreshadow of it in his Gettysburg Address, where he believed that the Constitution had failed. Because, I mean, how could a Constitution be workable if it ended up in a civil war with, hundreds of thousands of people killed? This was not a successful Constitution. So what he came up with was to go back to the Declaration of Independence and, you know, a government by the people, for the people. And that was the thought. And it was the way that the nation healed. And right now, we are running into another sort of situation. And as to what that thought is and what it will be, I don't know, because it usually comes as a bit of a surprise. But I would say we'll probably find out within the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, speaking of running, last question I want to ask you here. You mentioned Uruguay, which is where you live. Historically speaking, it seems to be that Uruguay is one of the places that a lot of people from the Western world are fleeing to for one reason or another. Why are you in Uruguay?
Partly because it is, the word is, the Spanish word is tranquilo. I mean, it is tranquil. It's, you know, things go to a different pace. I mean, we travel, you know, Uruguay travels at, you know, at 60 kilometers an hour, not 60 miles an hour. So it's like it's maybe 10 years behind the times. And its thinking is also probably there. It's a bit conservative. It's very, you just got to love it. It's a beautiful place. I find it really invigorating and wonderful to live here. It is really tough. There's a lot of things that, there's bureaucracies. It can get very Kafkaesque. But then, you know, where else, you know, every place can be like that. But it does have one really redeeming function and that or attribute. The air is unbelievably clean. There is a tremendous amount of water. The people are absolutely good to look at and wonderful to talk to.
Ivan, I thank you very much for being on the program with us. We should mention again, your book is Eye of the Moon, and people can find out more information by going to your website, ivanobolensky.com. Ivan, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Oh, Peter, thank you.
Ivan Obolensky, author of Eye of the Moon. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page number for this show, which is show number 0496, and you'll find links to Ivan's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the star and producer of the indie film Pretty Broken. Plus, Ernie Smith from Tedium is back on the show, this time talking about the history of the suggestion box. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Let's get back to the stuff. Scientists in New Zealand say they have found a USB memory stick containing holiday photos inside a frozen slab of seal poo. The scat, valuable for studying the health of leopard seals, had been stored in a freezer for a year before it was thawed out for analysis. Concealed deep inside the scat was a USB stick. The National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research, or NIWA, said on its website, the stick was in good condition considering where it had come from, and the researchers let it dry out for a few weeks. It contained photos of sea lions at Porpoise Bay on New Zealand's South Island and a video of a mother sea lion and her baby frolicking in shallow waters. The only clue to who might have taken them is the nose of a blue kayak, NIWA said, adding that the return of the USB stick comes with a price. The leopard seal researchers would like some more leopard seal scat, please, they said. Wow. These guys are easy to shop for at Christmas, huh? Gee, I don't know if I'd want that memory stick back. You know, some memories are best forgotten. A couple was magnet fishing in the Ocklawaha River near Ocala, Florida, using a magnet to try to locate precious metals. After their venture, they put their finds into a 5-gallon bucket, put the bucket in the trunk, drove to a nearby Taco Bell, and only then called the police to report their haul included a World War II-era hand grenade. The restaurant was evacuated while the Marion County Sheriff's Office bomb squad responded. Bomb techs determined that the firing pin mechanism on the grenade did not appear to be functional, but they removed the grenade for destruction at another location. The Taco Bell was closed for over an hour while the grenade was dealt with. You know, generally speaking, one might expect some sort of explosion at a Taco Bell, but not one of this variety. A man and woman spent an hour in the electronics department of a Walmart store in Shelbyville, Tennessee, arriving at 3 a.m. According to Shelbyville Police Detective Sergeant Sam Jacobs, whenever someone would walk by, they would walk off and stay gone for a couple of minutes. According to security camera video, whenever the coast was clear, they'd load computer printer cartridges into a tote bag, which they also stole, and once full, they wheeled it out a side door that had no alarm on it. Evidently, they had prior knowledge they could go out that door, Jacob said. The store says the couple stole 332 ink cartridges worth $11,427. The first theory was that the couple would use the cartridges to print counterfeit money, but the store said the cartridges were for multiple brands and types of printers, not to mention they did not steal any paper. So now investigators aren't sure of the motive. Bizarre is the only way I can describe it, Jacobs said. Well, hold on there, Jacobs. You know, it's worth $11,427. Isn't that considered some kind of clue, Sergeant? Actually, the high cost of toner cartridges should be considered a crime in itself. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, agents with the Stanislaus County, California Auto Theft Task Force spotted a stolen vehicle and gave chase. Eventually, the driver crashed and fled on foot into a nearby dairy farm. Search dogs located the suspect in a cow pen where he had buried himself in manure. Officers surrounded the pen but didn't bother to go in after whomever it was. They just shouted that he should come out. About an hour later, 40-year-old Brian Woolever announced that he was wet and cold and ready to surrender. He was charged with auto theft, possession of a stolen vehicle, and felony evading. You know, it's going to take him a little longer than most thieves to clean up his act. Who's the unlucky cop, by the way, who has to cuff him and put him in the back of the squad car? And after he's taken to jail, did they just save some time and money and burn the police vehicle he was transported in? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Actress Gillian Clare is one of the stars of the indie film Pretty Broken. She plays Lindsay Liu, a college dropout on the verge of divorce who reconnects with her family after her father goes missing in a mountain climbing accident in the Himalayas. Gillian joins us via Skype from California. Hi, Gillian.
Hello.
Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Now, I said you're the star. You're also a producer of this, are you not?
Yes, I am. It's very exciting.
What brought you to this story? Why did you feel it was important not only to star in but produce?
Well, I got the script for Pretty Broken, which at the time was called Free for All, in about 2013, I believe it was. And when I got the script, I immediately fell in love with the character, and I thought that it was interesting to show a young woman who's not in college and isn't, you know, addicted to drugs or, you know, having these awful things happen to her. It's just a real slice of life. And I think it's very hard to come by in my generation to find films that really just touch on super truthful moments in a character's life. And that's why I fell in love with it.
Now, you just explained something that people are not aware of necessarily, and that is sometimes when you get an idea or come across a script for a film, it can take a long period of time between when you discover it and when you get to put it on celluloid. What was the journey in all the years it took from when you first saw the script to getting this movie made?
Right. Well, I had actually met Brett and Jill, who are the director and the writer of Pretty Broken, on another film in 2013. We filmed it up in Oregon as well. And at the time, I was a bit too young to convincingly play a 22-year-old. I've always looked younger on screen, and at that time, I was only 20. So we waited a bit just for me to age into the role a little more. And it's also just, you know, extremely hard to make an indie film and to get everyone together that's needed. But we eventually found all the right people. And I believe when something's supposed to happen, it's supposed to happen.
Now, you have been around for a while as an actress. You appeared in the original Spider-Man movie with Tobey Maguire. You were in Catch Me If You Can. Those are two well-known and big-budget movies. Is it a mindset switch to go from something like a big-budget movie with craft services and all that comes with it and all the pomp and ceremony to an indie film?
It definitely is. I've been working in the indie world for about 10 years now, from web series to indie films. I've done several indie films that weren't of my own doing. but I think it's really fun to do indie because there's such an intimacy, and you really get to know everybody on set and all the characters, and the crew becomes kind of like your family. You spend, you know, 3 weeks shooting this film on a tight budget, and you all just become super, super close. So that's why I love independent filmmaking so much. I mean, obviously everybody loves to be brought milkshakes to their trailers and big budget films, but I love the independent world, and I love everyone that I work with.
Now, as I say, you're wearing two hats in this movie. You are a star, you are also a producer, which I guess it's a little more difficult to be a star and a director where you're directing yourself.
Yeah.
But even so, as you're acting, as you're in the moment with a scene, do you often think, Do you often put on your producer hat at the same time and concern yourself with budgets and all the other things that a producer has to deal with?
No, I was very fortunate. There's four producers, me, Susan Bernhardt, Brett Eichenberger, and Joel Remensnyder, and everything that I needed to do producer-wise kind of was before or after. I've been really involved in the post-production phase with all the social media and the graphics, and obviously in the beginning when we were getting everything together and stuff like that. But when it came to set, I just purely focused on Lindsay and the character and everything that needed to be done in the scenes and where she was as a person. And then when we called wrap on the day, then I'd put that producer hat back on and figure out what we needed for tomorrow.
Your movie, Broken, Pretty Broken, is going to be released theatrically and also on VOD on March the 1st, correct?
Yes, that's correct. We're so excited to finally put it out in the world.
How do people get an opportunity to see it if they're not one of the people who live in an area where it's going to be theatrically released?
It'll be on iTunes and Amazon and all of those online streaming sites, Vudu and all that kind of stuff, March 1st.
And how do you go about, just for yourself, looking for either a role or a project to work on?
Well, I mean, I have a great manager, and they're always looking for stuff for me and sending me out on cool opportunities. So that's one aspect of it. And then, you know, sometimes I get things like this that just pop into my life. And, you know, I directed a film a couple years ago. And even with that, it was interesting because it just kind of popped into my life like it was meant to be there and it was meant to happen. So I think the things that you're supposed to do kind of find you. And then in the meantime, you just keep going with the hustle.
Does carving out a niche in the indie world help your street cred in the big budget world?
I'm not sure if it helps in the big budget world, but I think the more that you can do on your own and the more content, good content, not just, you know, YouTube videos, good content, good films that you can put out, I think the more people will start to know who you are. I super look up to the Duplass brothers and everything they've done in the independent world and how they've translated to the mainstream industry, and I love what they've done, and I really look up to them.
Again, you've been acting and working in this business since you were 7 years old. When you first started as a kid, where did you see your career going, and is it on the path that you'd like it to be on?
I mean, I have no idea. I just did it because I loved it. So I never really looked at the future like I had to accomplish a certain thing at a certain time. I think when you're a kid actor, you know, you always want to be on like a Disney show or a Nickelodeon show because that's just what you grow up with. But even since I was a young kid, I've always looked up to people like Kate Winslet and Natalie Portman in the acting aspect. And that's kind of the route that I'd like to follow. I just want to do things that inspire me and that I think will inspire others.
Again, your current film, which is coming out on March the 1st and is available, will be available on VOD, video on demand, is Pretty Broken. And you play Lindsay Liu. Tell us about some of the other people who are in this film. Give them their props.
For sure. There is Tyler Christopher, known for his work on General Hospital and Days of Our Lives, and he plays Jerry Carlisle, who is an ex-children's program star, now turned car salesman that kind of intertwines himself into Lindsay's family. There's Preston Bailey, who plays Monty Liu, and he is my little brother in it, and he's kind of like this quirky high schooler who thinks he's a psychic. And Preston and I have known each other since we were small children, so he kind of like is my little brother in real life. So it was really fun to play brother and sister on screen. Peter Holden, who plays my father, Montgomery, he's fantastic. He's a veteran in this business, and we played father-daughter in another film, Alien Abduction, as well. We have Stacey Edwards, who plays my mom, Caroline Liu, and she is phenomenal, just an incredible person, and her character, everything that she brought to Caroline was absolutely amazing. And then we have Adam Chambers, who plays Scott, who is Lindsay's new love interest, and Adam and I have been friends for a while. We worked on another film called The Kitchen together back in 2011, I think. And it was really fun. Everyone is so talented. We were so lucky with our cast.
Well, congratulations with the film. Good luck with it. The movie is called Pretty Broken. Jillian, thanks for being on the program with us.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Actress Jillian Clare, star and producer of the indie film Pretty Broken. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this week's show, which is show number 0496, and you'll find links to Jillian's site, where you'll also find information about her film, including watching the trailer. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Have you ever thrown out a small check that you got in the mail for a class action lawsuit? If so, this segment is for you. According to a report I read recently, hundreds of millions of dollars in class action settlements go unclaimed each year. There are many reasons for this, but one of the most common is that when people think a lawsuit is frivolous, they don't want to accept money they think was unfairly taken from someone else. That's a noble position, but a lawyer who fights frivolous lawsuits recently told me something surprising. He said, "It's better to cash the check." Let's be fair, that doesn't sound right, but he says it's better to take the money and give it to a charity of your choice than not to claim it. The reason? Unclaimed money usually doesn't go back to the person or the company who was sued. Instead, it often goes to a pet cause of the lawyers who filed the lawsuit. It may even include the law school where they got their degree. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
You're experiencing the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Ernie Smith from Tedium about the history of the suggestion box. Also, there is an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. Here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Have I mentioned my book, by the way? Great Conversations. My interviews with Two Men on the Moon and A Galaxy of Stars, it's still available, you know. Published by Bear Manor Media. You can find the book at Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, all the Amazons if you want. And it's also available at BearManorMedia.com. It's in Dead Tree version if you like to flip the pages. Or you can get it for your e-reader, for your Kindle, for instance. It's available in all platforms. So, buy the book. That's all I'm going to say about that right now. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Utah's Uinta County Sheriff's Office announced the arrest of three men in a kidnapping case, including ringleader Cody Joseph Alvarez. Now, someone called 911 to report they received a Facebook message from a friend who said that they were being held hostage in a home by a gunman. Sure enough, when deputies arrived, they found three suspects holding six victims hostage. Deputies say a backpack near Alvarez included handguns, drugs, empty baggies, cash, and Alvarez's wallet. But the situation wasn't a drug deal gone bad. Alvarez allegedly admitted to deputies that he believed someone had taken his sentimental bandana and would not let anyone leave until he got it back. Well, I'm sure authorities will gladly give the bandana back to him in 6 to 12 years. And finally, a 19-year-old man from Nice, France, has received a 4-month suspended sentence for a clever plot he hatched in September. The man, known only as Adele, not the person who sings, I'm sure, removed a PlayStation 4 from a supermarket shelf on September 17th and took it to the produce aisle, where he weighed it and printed out a price sticker for fruit. Then he used the self-checkout line to pay and left the store with a $389 piece of electronics for about $10. Adele sold the PlayStation for $114 to buy a train ticket. The next day, he tried the same scheme, but police caught him in the act. He will only have to serve his sentence if he reoffends. Okay, he committed a crime for which he was caught and received a sentence, if only suspended. But come on, you have to give him major brownie points for coming up with this one. I mean, he's not quite ready for an Ocean's 11 movie, but give the guy his props. That's cool. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Ernie Smith, the man behind the website and newsletter known as Tedium, which is subtitled The Dull Side of the Internet, is back on the program. This time around, he's here to talk about a recent newsletter that took a look at the history of the suggestion box. Ernie joins us on the line via Skype from Virginia. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, how's it going?
Just tickety-boo. Nice to have you back on the program. So the history of the suggestion box, I'm sure it had really altruistic beginnings, but nowadays, as we have electronic suggestion boxes, that's just basically a data grab. But it wasn't the case when it first started back in the day, correct?
Yeah, it basically was a situation, I would say that it really kind of came into its own in the days of the Industrial Revolution, especially as it kind of sped up during the wartime years during World War II. And basically, the idea was to offer sort of a line of communication between leadership and the employees to basically have a place to allow ideas not to kind of die on the vine, but to actually reach somebody of note.
Now, when you say employees, is it all the way down, or was it basically upper management trying to get to lower management or people who can be decision makers, as opposed to the actual, for lack of the better term, common man, the grunts who work on the floor, as it were?
I think that there's definitely a degree of, even people at the bottom had kind of a say. An example I cite in the piece is of an employee who worked at Raytheon, I believe is the name. It's a major aerospace firm. And basically, he was a low-level employee, and all he did was he basically was a welder. But he had an idea. He did the blueprints of it. He actually put the blueprints inside of the suggestion box, and somebody higher up saw it, and it eventually led to him actually getting a job as a full-on engineer. So it's definitely a situation where it's a way for people at the bottom to kind of reach up a little bit higher. You know, as it turns out, people actually read the suggestion box, or at least they did it at some point.
And I'm guessing, again, as I said, it was an altruistic idea when it first started. I would say that's a situation on both sides. And the reason why I bring that up is it's one thing to have a suggestion box and ask to hear about what suggestions your employees might have. But I'm sure there was a period of time, especially in today's day and age, where a suggestion box merely becomes a complaint box.
Yeah, I definitely think that that's certainly the case. I mean, I think that, these days, a place where you most commonly see a suggestion box is probably like a fast food place, like somewhere where it's a company that has to deal with a lot of consumers. Consumers are often quite frustrated or angry about, very basic things. And I think that, there is a degree with the suggestion box of not just being something that started out as a employee to, upper management kind of thing. But also a consumer to company kind of thing.
And again, that brings me back to my original concern with the example you just gave of a fast food restaurant. How do you avoid it becoming literally a data grab? Because people don't usually put in suggestions or give suggestions without being asked to give either their email address or a phone number or something like that.
I think that it's, it's pretty tough. And one of the things that I kind of make the point in the piece is that there's this tendency, I think, with suggestion boxes, to have sort of evolved into sort of more more aggressive data collection where they don't even ask for your, you know, like they don't even ask for some of your information. They just kind of glean it off just based on what you're doing on their website with trackers and so on and so forth. But I think in terms of a suggestion box, I mean, often, you know, I would assume that anonymity would probably be one way to handle that, rather than, you know, like grabbing your email address and basically just kind of, you know, pulling your information, and, you know, then you get emails from them for the rest of your life, basically.
Now, you also mentioned in the article that the suggestion box became a key communication tool during World War II. Explain that.
Yeah, during World War II, one of the things that was really fascinating was that the suggestion box actually became kind of a key tool that was promoted with propaganda. There was actually a film that was created by the U.S. government called Suggestion Box, and it was made by the U.S. Office of War Information. And basically, it goes in and makes the case about how those suggestion boxes would actually lead to information that got spread to different factories around the country, and would basically be used to sort of ramp up the war effort in the U.S.
Really? Exactly. How did that work?
Basically, I would say that, you know, a worker would put a suggestion into the box, and basically, you know, somebody would see it, and it would get passed up the chain of command to basically allow for information to be shared between, you know, between different companies. It was not necessarily a situation where, you know, trade secrets were being like hidden away, like, you know, you might have nowadays. It basically was a situation that, because of the war effort, they were trying to figure out ways to better distribute information so that, you know, so that everybody was kind of on the same page in terms of what was needed and what ideas would create efficiencies in the supply chain process.
Clearly, in reading this article that you've written on Tedium, the suggestion box is something that has played an important role through history. Is it as important today as it was in the past, or is it something that's going the way of buggy whips?
You know, I would say the buggy whip is quite a good comparison. I think that the suggestion box isn't totally dead. I think that there are places where it still makes sense, but I think largely due to the amount of digital access and the fact that so much can be done without, you know, without the use of pen and paper in terms of sharing information and distribution and such, I think that it kind of creates a situation where the suggestion box, I almost think it created kind of a monster in terms of like it creating an appetite for companies to like really want data, you know, like on their employees or on, you know, or from their consumers. I think that the suggestion box itself is probably going the way of the dodo, but I think the ideas that it sort of extended upon later on as technology improved and efficiencies were made in the way that companies got a hold of information like this. I think that it almost created a situation where it made, you know, I think it was made obsolete only because there are so many other ways to grab the information these days.
Well, in your estimation, what companies or what types of companies would best be able to use the idea of a suggestion box in this day and age?
You know, I think that definitely it would probably be more along the small business type. I think that more elaborate companies like, you know, say your Facebooks and your Googles of the world, Like they're way past this point. But I think that for smaller organizations, I think that for companies that have a little bit more of a hands-on approach to the way that they handle consumers, the suggestion box still has a lot of value.
It's another fascinating read on Tedium. This one is basically the history of the suggestion box. People can find Tedium online at tedium.co. Ernie, I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Ernie Smith, writer of the website and newsletter Tedium. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0496, and you'll find links to Ernie's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We have reached that point of the program, boys and girls, the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
44-year-old Richard J. Betters Jr. of Schenectady, New York, has encountered police detectives in nearby Rotterdam before, which explains why he had one officer's phone number in his contacts list. So on February 6th, when a detective mistakenly received a text from Betters offering drugs, it was a law enforcement slam dunk. The detective played along with Betters, offering to meet him at the Taco Bell in Rotterdam, where he arrested Betters for criminal possession of a controlled substance, which was oxycodone pills. He was held on $20,000 bail. Now, why? Oh, why? If you are a criminal, would you leave contact information for a cop on your phone? And even if you texted said cop by accident, not realize at any time during the proceedings who you were actually texting with in a criminal matter? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0496. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0496. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were to play this episode backwards, go ahead, try and figure that out.